Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 177 of Registry Matters. Good evening, fine sir. How are you?
Fantastic. And now the Registry Matters has passed my age.
Oh, man, look at that. We should have like some like pops and whistles and all that stuff. Did you get all your snacks and all that stuff consolidated leading up to the show?
Yes, I did. I closed down my cannabis.
You closed down what?
My cannabis.
I didn't realize that you were into these. Are these like brownies? Are you token? What are you doing?
Well, I'm actually going to put in an application for the edibles, but I don't have my card yet, but I'm going to be looking into that.
Holy moly. I would like to remind everybody to click like and subscribe and share and all those other fun things to support the podcast. It would be fantastic if, you know what, Larry, if we could get to 1,000 subscribers on YouTube, then we could make some money on YouTube.
I've heard that. There's an attorney I've been watching in Florida that's been building his disability practice with YouTube, and his subscriber list is growing exponentially.
Huh. Do you, you had mentioned something about trying to possibly do some cross content of some sort. Did that move anywhere?
I haven't reached out to him just yet on that. I've been listening to many of his episodes, and he politicizes the disability and this process a little bit more than I feel comfortable with. So I would have to make sure we have a conversation that we're not taking partisan positions here on things, but he does tend to do that more than I feel comfortable with. But otherwise he gives really good information.
Interesting. All right. Well, that's enough of the pre-show banter, I suppose. Now that you're getting dope for the show, you're going to be like, "Hey folks, welcome to the show." And you'll be all slow and silly sounding. What's going on tonight? There's something kind of big you want to talk about, isn't there?
Well, there's a case from Montana that has to deal with a person who had a registration obligation in Idaho, and he subsequently relocated to Montana, and he has successfully successfully challenged the constitutionality of the provision that requires that catch-all provision. So we're going to go do a deep dive. That's going to be our major event. We've got some questions from people who are inside prisons, and we've got one question from a person who's outside prison, and we've got some articles, and we are going to go back on episode 160 and talk about Indiana.
Man, we got, like, are we going to make it in an hour?
You're going to have to be very fast.
Okay, well, let's go. Would you like to start with like the audio clip, the voicemail message?
Sure, that's a good place to start.
All right, here we go. Here's a voicemail message from a listener.
Yes, I was listening to the podcast tonight on YouTube, and I heard Larry say to be a Tier 3 in the state of Virginia, you had to be convicted with at least 2 charges. I only have 1 charge, and I am a Tier 3 in Virginia, going on 21 years. I was retroactively changed in 2008, and I was hoping he could give an explanation on this on the next podcast about the state of Virginia, if it's you got to have 2 charges to be a Tier 3, because I definitely only have 1 charge. Thanks a lot. FYP.
I sort of remember hearing you speak it that way, though.
Well, the reason why we're coming back on this is because apparently I confused everybody, and I'm going to try to clear it up. When we talk about tiers, we often get confused in and of themselves when we talk about tiers, because some states have levels where they've actually assigned a person a level based on their offense and a risk. They've done an individualized assessment. And the Adam Walsh Act, the federal Adam Walsh Act, does not support that approach. They support the approach of taking a categorical look at the offense and putting it into a tier category. And one of the categories is a tier three. And a tier three is, by federal recommendations, anyone who has previously been at tier two and has a subsequent conviction for another sexual offense. That would, having previously been a tier two, that would make that person a tier three. But before the Adam Walsh Act ever existed, a lot of states, the overwhelming majority of states, already had lifetime registration. Remember, tier three under federal guidelines is lifetime. Many states already had a lifetime provision for people who had multiple sexual offense convictions. So what I was trying to communicate to him is that some states consider it to be multiple convictions if it comes within the same case. And some cases, the majority of the states consider it to be multiple convictions if it's within two separate case numbers. And the way to think of it is like a habitual offender statute. A person can go out and commit 27 felonies and never be apprehended. And if you look at that literally, you'll say, well, that person was a habitual offender. No, they weren't a habitual offender, because when they were brought to justice on the 27 felonies, if they were all combined into one case, that's one judicial intervention.
Sure.
So it would not be fair to make that person a habitual offender merely because they have not previously had any intervention for us to determine if they are going to continue breaking the law or not. Well, that same concept would apply with a sexual offense registry requirement. If you make a person a lifetime simply because they have multiple convictions within the same case, that's not really fair, because we don't know if intervention worked. So that's why the federal guidelines, as rigid as they are, they don't recommend making a person a tier three based on multiple convictions unless it's a subsequent conviction to the earlier conviction that triggered the registration obligation. So I was trying to convey to him that it's very confusing, and some states will make you, like Colorado, you're not eligible for removal if you have two convictions within the same case, two counts within the same case. We had an attorney on, Colleen Kelly, who explained that. And so that was what I was trying to convey.
All right. Well, that turned out to be like clear as mud. Again, I'm just kidding. Like all of this stuff, Larry, turns out to be super complicated. Every state has their own different set of rules and conditions that fall under this or that. Like, this is like always like a nightmare. And when you talk to this person, well, their conditions are very different than we'll talk to somebody else in a different state, like between their case and then the statutes and all that stuff. Every person is their own individual little entity. It's a pain in the ass.
That is correct. Virginia has the prerogative of making a person a tier three if they choose to, even though they did not meet the definitions that the feds recommended. Virginia can make everyone a tier three if they like.
Right.
Because that at least equals the recommendations.
Okay, I was just thinking, because like the way there's the federal guidelines, but then everyone else, not necessarily everyone else, the states have their own tiering structure, and what falls into what? Those are just recommendations of what they want you to do. But the federal guidelines, if I'm not mistaken, correct me, of course, is there's no living or work presence restrictions. So the states have added those.
Correct.
So they can just like, well, we're not going to follow anything that they say, and we're going to exceed everything unless it crosses the boundaries of being unconstitutional. They can do what the F they want to.
That is correct. And remember, the feds are only dangling this in exchange for federal funds. You don't have to do any of this, but these are minimum standards to receive federal funding. You need to at least classify certain people as a tier three. It's a much narrower list than actually what the states have adopted their version of the Adam Walsh Act. Most of the states have gone beyond what's recommended. But you can do that because you've met the minimum recommendations. Again, Virginia can declare people lifetime that weren't recommended to be lifetime by federal. It's not that confusing. The feds merely have made recommendations for you to get your money. You have to do these things.
Okay. And I'm totally going to need you. We'll move on. I'm totally going to need you to set up this video clip of why you want to do this one.
Okay. So what we talk about frequently on here is the difficulty in doing criminal justice reform. Now, let's be clear. I'm talking about positive reform. Anytime you make changes in the law, that's considered reform. I'm interested in positive reforms that result in fewer people in prison, fewer people being arrested, and alternatives to incarceration. And I talk about the difficulty, and I say that there's vilification primarily coming from the conservatives. So I'm setting this up to give you an example in real time. We have a special election for a new member of Congress in my district here because our congressperson, Deb Holland, was appointed to serve as Interior Secretary. So there's a vacant seat, and the candidates have been named by their respective parties, and a special election is going to be held June 1st. This is the conservative running, and this is what he is saying about his opponent, Melanie Stansberry.
All right, here we go. Put that, and I will press this button, and everything will work.
To pass the BREATHE Act in Congress.
Melanie Stansberry supports the most dangerous legislation in America as Albuquerque faces record numbers of homicides. Legislation that defunds and dismantles the police, empties every federal prison in 10 years. Murderers, rapists, and child molesters walking free.
We need to pass the BREATHE Act in Congress.
Stop the madness. Stop Melanie Stansberry before it's too late.
I'm Mark Moores, and I approve this message.
Wow, that's pretty aggressive. They seem to have just taken like a quick little soundbite. We need to pass the BREATHE Act. Like, okay, we need to do it right away. There's probably a whole other sentence after that that describes why, but they cut that off.
Yeah, I don't know enough about the BREATHE Act to really talk about that. That's not the focus. What I'm focusing on is the vilification. There's no one running for office that's advocating emptying all federal prisons that I'm aware of. And if that's in the BREATHE Act, again, I don't know, but I can tell you no responsible candidate or even irresponsible candidate is advocating emptying federal prisons. But what's really so disingenuous about that is that federal prisons are not filled with rapists and child molesters, because for the federal government to have jurisdiction over sexual offenses, there has to be an interstate component. Most rapists and most child molesters would be in state prisons. So to attack Melanie Stansberry for putting rapists and child molesters on the streets, that's so and even murderers. In order for there to be a murder, there has to be a federal jurisdictional hook. Most murderers are in state prisons.
You remember the DC sniper like in the early 90s?
I do.
Malvo is the last name. And so they were trying to figure out, if I recall, they were trying to figure out a way to make it a federal component, but those crimes were committed in D.C., probably not D.C. That would have been federal. No, I guess that would be still like in that district, but there's no way to prosecute them. So they tried to do it in Virginia, where it had the harshest sentence. But because they killed people in those three areas, there's still no federal component that hooked them in, as I recall. I could be wrong, but that's what I recall. That's kind of what I'm trying to do about
that. You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. And what makes this so disingenuous is that the average voter, whether they're in this state or where they are, they don't realize that. So they're hearing this sensationalized ad that murderers, rapists, and child molesters will be free walking amongst us within 10 years. And they're going to vote in a terrified fashion for the guy that sponsored that ad. I don't even want to really give him airtime, but sure, they're going to vote for him. A lot of our people that are on the registry will vote for him because he espouses conservative values, but yet they profess they're for reform. This is an example of what makes reform so difficult. Melanie cannot actually go out and talk about what she'd like to do because she's going to receive this from now until until the special election on June 1st. This is what's coming, and it's being run. This ad and variations of this ad are being run continuously here.
Sure.
This
sure.
is and what
I'm sure
we
you
need.
Listen to the radio a lot. I'm sure they're doing it on the radio too, right?
At radio and TV. This is what we need to stop, folks. You need to call the people who run ads like this and say, I would have voted for you, but I reject what you're doing. And if you do that, they will stop running these type of ads. They run these ads because they work.
Doesn't this then promote the idea that politicians are just all liars and you can't trust any of them?
Why would it do that?
Because of you're aware of it. I don't suppose that the average voter is necessarily aware of it. But as you look at things, I remember the governor of Georgia here doing some similar kind of ad against the candidate that was running against him and putting up something that she voted against, something that made life easier for PFRs. And she was doing it because it didn't promote anything that was good for public safety. It was based on evidence and whatever, that making it a 2,000 foot living restriction, whatever it was at the time. But that's what was running on the air. Then because they're making it such an exaggerated point, because it's not anything reality based, it's just about fear, then people go, well, politicians lie. So the people that would analyze these things, they know that that side of the politicians lie. And then going in the other direction, the right side leaning people would watch ads from left leaning politicians doing things similar, exaggerating and taking things out of context against their opponents as well. So both sides do things that are exaggerating, and then no one knows what to believe from anybody.
Well, I guess if you frame the question that way, I would agree. But I think we have some responsibility to be informed.
Ah, there you go.
You couldn't live 40, 50, or 60 years and not realize that no one has proposed closing federal prisons. All of them. we've had a prison right. system ever since the country has existed.
And long before that, in all the other countries prior to, there has been a way to deal with people that have perform some kind of thing against society.
There are people who have advocating sending fewer to prison, but no one has talked about closing all federal prisons. That's absurd. I think we have a duty to inform ourselves. It might mean giving up one afternoon at Hooters or giving up watching the Broncos play football, but you're going to have to spend some time understanding and be an educated and informed voter.
I don't know, Larry. That sounds like a pretty tall order right there.
Sure.
Or, hey, they could like listen to this podcast and possibly get some ideas on how to make life easier for PFRs. There's a thought. There's only roughly a million of us nationwide, like actually directly impacted. Forget all the other ones, like the handful of people in chat that are just 1 degree out from the person that's the registry person. I don't know, man. We're never going to win. All right, Larry, let's move on then, because we have like 8,000 questions and things to cover about this case, this Randall Mengers versus Austin Knudsen. Is that what it is?
Well, I would say Knudsen, but...
Okay, you know, Knudsen, and forgive me, because like I'm butchering your name, and I apologize. But let's dive over there for a little while, because this could take up like the majority of the time, and then we'll have to skip over, not skip, but really compress the stuff at the end. You said it's like, it's 70 pages, right? I read all of it. But so you put this in here, and it's from U.S. District Judge in Montana. What is this about, sir?
Well, it is a challenge against Mr. Knudsen, who is the Attorney General of the state of Montana, and Gary Cedar, who is the Bureau Chief of the Montana Crime Information Bureau, and Sarah Malaiki, who is the head of the Sexual and Violent Offenders Program for Missoula County Sheriff's Office. The question before the court is whether Montana may force plaintiff Randall Mengers to register as a sexual offender for engaging in consensual oral sex with another male back in 1993. That's
93,
what the case is
Larry,
about.
Why do we care? Why do we care about something from 93? Larry, you'll be surprised. I read all 72 pages and I found it absolutely fascinating. It was an amazing read and I stayed up for all of it. He is required to register for having consensual sex with a 16-year-old when he was 18 years back in 93. That's a long time ago, Larry, that we would care now. But as I understand it, that wouldn't require registry obligation, but he engaged in homosexual activity and Idaho did not go lightly on him did they?
They did not. And I was having a pre-show chat with another person, and I said, this might explain why Idaho Senator Larry Craig, a few years back, decided to do his homosexual activity in the restroom in the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport rather than the state of Idaho, because apparently they do not take kindly to crimes against nature. He was sentenced to 15 years, and upon his release from imprisonment, he was required under Idaho law, and still would be required under Idaho law, to register as a sexual offender. And that is at some point he relocated to Montana, but he still could not escape his registration requirement, because under Montana's Sexual Violent Offender Registration Act, he must register as a sexual offender in Montana because he's required to register in Idaho.
Right. And that's what we talk about pretty much all the time, of if you were ever required to register or convicted of a sexual offense in another state, blah, 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 all the little nuances there, you have to register here.
Yes, that's the famous catch-all clause that they have. And so, yes, as he has to register as a sexual offender, because anyone who is convicted of a sexual offense, it has to register. And critical to this case, it includes any violation of that definition includes any violation of a law of another state for which the offender was required to register as a sexual offender after an adjudication or conviction. So he is a person. He was required and still would be required in Idaho to register, because they haven't updated anything in Idaho. So he would still be required to register today. So Montana said, well, I mean, you are a person, right? You did relocate here, right? You are required to register in Idaho, right? So you have to register here. So what's your problem?
I'm surprised, though, at how fast it moved, because I hear about things. It just takes, like even the Georgia case, like the signs in the yards, that took years to get to go through before it got heard by the federal judge. How did this just happen that he just filed in December? How did he pull this off in a handful of months?
I'm still trying to figure that out.
Okay.
But you're correct. It did move very quickly. He filed this suit the December 9th of 2020, and he asserted a plethora of violations. He said the registration requirement was unconstitutional as applied to him. Now remember, we talk about facial and as applied. And he said it violated the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. He said it violated the equal protection clause of the 14th Amendment. And he said it violated Article 2, Section 10 of the Montana Constitution. And he moved for a preliminary injunction requesting that the court enjoin the defendants and their officers, agents, and employees and attorneys and any person who is in participation from requiring him to register as a sex offender in Montana. This was an amazingly fast moving case.
Did he also challenge in the source state in Idaho about the constitutionality of the law?
He actually did. He has a parallel action going in Idaho. He's challenging the constitutionality of the law because the U.S. Supreme Court had decided back in the 80s that it was okay for states to criminalize sodomy between same-sex individuals. And then some years later, that was the Hardwick case. And then some years later, and I don't know the year that they decided Lawrence, but I think it was Lawrence versus Texas, they decided that it was a person's right to engage in sexual activity with a person of their choice. So he's challenging the constitutionality of a registration requirement because he's arguing that the U.S. Supreme Court has said that the behavior he engaged in cannot be declared criminal. So that is, in fact, a parallel challenge. And interesting, the defendants moved, in light of that parallel challenge, that this action in Montana should be stayed and held in abeyance. And the court did not go along with that. The court set a hearing on all the state's motions and decided to let the case proceed on the merits. And they had a hearing on March 30th, and Mingus testified. And this case, there's a decision been rendered, and it's just amazing.
You talk about the importance of standing. Did either of the states contest standing? I mean, why would they contest standing? They're the ones that did it.
Well, they would contest standing because you never get to a merits decision if the person doesn't have standing. So, yes, it appears that they did. Because remember, you cannot lose a case if you don't go to trial. I tell that to people right, all the time. Okay, they roll their heads. If I'm the state and I can avoid you ever having a trial, I have no risk of losing, do I?
Fair.
So it appears that they did, and the court had the following to say. At all stages of litigation, I'm quoting from the opinion, at all stages of the litigation, a plaintiff must maintain a personal interest in the dispute. The doctrine of standing generally assesses whether the interest exists at the onset of the case. In order to establish standing, plaintiffs must show, one, they have suffered an injury in fact. That is a concrete and particularized and actual or imminent, not conjectural or hypothetical. Now, I remember with a challenge called International Megan's Law, I said it can't be hypothetical. Yes, we'll see. I didn't invent that. This is legal doctrine. And two, the injury is fairly traceable to the challenge action of the defendants. And three, it's likely, as opposed to merely speculative, that the injury will be redressed by a favorable decision. Now, that's on page 9 of the opinion. So, folks, I don't make this stuff up. This is legal doctrine about standing and about what the courts can do. And you have to have standing. Not liking something is not enough for you to take it to court unless you have standing.
To circle back to the point you just made about IML, International Megan's Law, they were challenging that this was going to create some kind of harm, but they hadn't decided what they were going to do with the passport, something like this, where the marking hadn't been identified, whether it was going to be some big red X or some kind of tiny little marker. How do you say that there's any sort of harm done? Attack was?
That is correct. They were speculating of what the Congress had put in there at the last moment, this passport identifier marking. And they left it up to the Attorney General and the State Department to figure out what it was going to be. And prior to figuring out what it was going to be, you cannot allege harm. You might have the requisite standing, but you can't speculate about harm because we don't know what the marker is going to be yet. So therefore, we do not know what harm it will inflict upon you. And legal doctrine that I didn't invent, and people rolled their eyes when I told them that, you can't prevail at this point because we don't know what they're going to do. So therefore, you're speculating. You can't do that.
Okay. It has to be an active damage. It can't be some sort of future. And you're saying speculative, hypothetical, whatever. It can't be some imaginary thing that you're saying, well, this could damage. It has to be damage done.
Well, you can't. The harm can be not happened yet. It can be imminent. But the harm wasn't imminent because, again, we didn't know what the marker was going to be like. So therefore, we didn't know if it was going to harm you or not.
Let me go back to the point you mentioned earlier about that Idaho requested a stay of this case pending resolution of the constitutional challenge in Idaho. The judge denied that request. Why and did he and was he correct?
I believe he was legally correct, and I will again read from his written opinion. Quote, the court also notes that the focal point of defendant's argument in favor of a stay is that resolution of the Idaho litigation will have an impact on this suit. It's far from certain. Any ruling from the court presiding over the Idaho litigation would have little more than persuasive effect. If the court concludes the Idaho statute obligating Mingus to register as a sexual offender is constitutional, this court is not precluded from reaching an opposite conclusion on Montana's requirement, and the defendants need not alter their enforcement of Montana law in response. So that's directly from the judge, and I think he's right because Idaho cannot remove him from Montana's registry. Montana could say, you are a person, aren't you? You were at one time convicted there, were you not? Even though they've declared the law invalid now, it is a fact that you were convicted, and they could continue to maintain the posture that you have to register. And the judge is absolutely right. Anything that the Idaho court would do would not necessarily preclude Montana from registering him. What will preclude Montana from registering him is what this judge did. He precluded them.
So tell me what the crux of the case is. The Montana Attorney General said this will blow a gaping hole in the registry. Do you think it will?
I don't think so. I don't think it will at all. I mean, that's exactly what you would say in a position he's in, because I would just about bet that the public not having taken the time to understand that this was consensual sexual activity between two people very close in age that would not have been illegal had it occurred between a heterosexual couple. The average person in Montana is not going to understand that. All they're going to understand is that there's a person on the registry that's being let go. But the reason why I think that it's correct is because the underlying criminal statute, which obligates Mingus to register in Idaho, and according to Montana, does not concern itself with the age of the sexual partner. As the court noted, quote, Mingus' underlying criminal conviction is not for having sexual contact with a minor. It is for having sexual contact with another male. And that's why Montana law requires him to register. Not for having sexual contact with a minor, but for having sexual contact with another male. And that's on the opinion at page 42. So this is different because it's clear that Idaho has a problem with same-sex conduct. And that's why they've required him to register. You hear the people in the LGBT community saying that the registry targets them. This is an example of what they are talking about.
What do you think the most critical and deciding factor was in the case?
Wow. Well, since he asserted, he made several assertions. In my opinion, although he got relief on all three, it was the Equal Protection Clause. The court stated, quote, in sum, Montana has no rational basis for forcing Mingus to register as a sexual offender on the basis of a 1994 Idaho conviction for engaging in oral or anal sex with a 16-year-old male when he was 18, but not forcing those to register as a sexual offender who were convicted in Idaho in 1994 at the age of 18 for engaging in vaginal sex with a 16-year-old female. That, I think, was the most critical thing, because here you've got, we clearly have an equal protection clause, and you would be protected had you had heterosexual relations. You would be protected, but the same Constitution doesn't protect you when you had same-sex conduct. I think that's what carried the day. But consequently, that operation of Montana law flouts the guarantee of equal protection, and Meningus enjoys actual success on the merits of his equal protection claim. That's the end of quote on page 58. I think that was of paramount importance to the judge. We have this clause in our Constitution, both the Montana and the U.S. Constitution. It's for a reason. You can't deny people equal protection. That's why the U.S. Supreme Court decided that people can marry regardless of gender, because the Constitution is blind to that.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. So let me try and understand this a little bit better from my point of view. The 14th Amendment was put in somewhere roughly right after the Civil War. So late 1800s, that has been there, that made not the 3/5 person thing and all that. So when did it become, I guess I'm trying to figure out how to word this so that it's clear and concise. When did it become the thing that same sex had the same equal protection as heterosexual, then for it to apply to this? Because Idaho law made it so that this was illegal sometime prior to 1993, a crime against humanity, whatever the hell you call it, a crime against nature. But somehow now it's okay. When did that switch occur, and how did that occur, I guess?
It happened when the Supreme Court ruled, seems like about 10 years ago, in the Defense of Marriage Act, that people have the right to marry. The Constitution has an equal protection clause. It is totally blind. It doesn't say you have equal protection as long as you do this with an opposite sex.
Sure.
So therefore, for all these years since the Defense of Marriage Act was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court, Idaho has not changed their law. So someone has finally put the challenge to them. I don't know if he'll succeed in Idaho, but he has certainly succeeded in Montana, and they're going to have a hard time turning this ship around. Now, having said that, there's always concern because the Supreme Court can change its mind. We've talked recently on episodes about how the Supreme Court has reversed itself on key issues and the blistering dissents by some of the liberal justices. Judge Anthony Kennedy is now gone, and we have a much different court than we had when the Defense of Marriage Act was passed. Is it possible that the Montana Attorney General could file a cert petition in the Supreme Court if the Ninth Circuit affirms the trial judge? Yes, it's possible. Is it possible that they could take a second look at this and say, well, that was that liberal bunch, and we don't see it that way? Yes, that's possible. They could backpedal and reverse themselves on Lawrence, but I hope not. I hope they don't, but they could.
If you want to drag this out for like another hour or so, but what did the court decide on the other claims?
Well, the court actually awarded him relief on the other claims as well. They said it violated substantive due process, equal protection, and his right to privacy, and these violations are ongoing. But to me, the most important one was the equal protection. I think without the equal protection argument, he wouldn't have won on privacy. And I'm not so sure due process would have carried the day as well. But in conjunction, he's won on all three. Now, this is an example of the judge has got three things they awarded relief on, so only one of them has to stick for the Ninth Circuit. And I'm banking on the equal protection sticking.
That is a pretty powerful argument these days as I see things coming up about equal protection. Do you think I kind of know the answer to this. Do you think Montana will appeal?
Yeah, they've already said that they will because it's blowing a hole in their registry, and they've announced that intention already. And I'd like to cut them a little bit of slack because that is kind of their job, is to defend the laws of the state. Now, in conjunction with defending that law, the attorney general could tell the state legislature, we're wrong on this. I encourage you to change the law. The problem with that is there are political risks with that. Can you imagine? We just played a clip about what happens with vilification. Can you imagine if this attorney general, let's assume that he's up for re-election in 2022. Can you imagine if he doesn't want to defend the sexual offender registry and he has an opponent that would like to assume the office of the attorney general of Montana? Can you imagine what those campaign ads would look like?
They would be pretty strong, I imagine.
And that's the reason why he's going to defend the law.
Does this apply to other people of a similar condition, same-sex kind of relationships with a non-minor and a minor, with things dating back that far?
I would say it will give relief if there are others, and how many there are in a small state like Montana, who knows? But it's not going to blow the gaping hole. This is not going to people can wish that this says that the catch-all provision requiring registration for out-of-state convictions magically goes away. It doesn't. This doesn't get you there. This is a small victory. It's huge for this person. It's huge for the reason reasons we've talked about. But this does not negate the catch-all provision.
When we rolled over into, I think it was 2020, I asked you to give me an idea of what you think like the victories were, and you said we continue to build a body of case law, I think is how you worded it. Does this go into that kind of bucket?
It absolutely does. It serves warning. Now we have to hope the Ninth affirms, the Ninth Circuit that is. We have to hope that the Ninth affirms. Now in the case of a recent adverse decision from the Ninth, they overturned in the Stephen Bay case. But if they affirm, this puts the states on notice in the Ninth Circuit that your catch-all provision better be carefully analyzed, because you can't just throw a catch-all provision in there that includes unconstitutional provisions like this does and expect it to withstand scrutiny. And this is an amazing victory, but it's not going to dismantle the registry or that catch-all provision.
So for the 12 people that live in Montana that are on the registry, this only impacts them with a pending thing in Idaho. What does that do for the Ninth then, or anybody else?
Well, it would be a similar application. If there are other states who have those type of statutes still on their books, like Idaho does, and it's triggering registration obligations all throughout the Ninth Circuit, I can tell you this. If I were living in Idaho right now and I had a conviction for a crime against nature, I would be packing my bags and headed toward another state. I mean, why would you want to stay in Idaho and be subject to the registry when all you have to do is argue this case is not precedential yet, but it soon will be if the Ninth upholds it. And if I had a choice to live in Montana or live in Idaho, I would choose Montana if I didn't have to register, wouldn't you?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, so you're saying the people that are already living in Idaho, like, they should be figuring out how to go move so they could possibly apply this challenge?
They would benefit from this challenge. If the Ninth upholds this, the same legal doctrine would apply to anybody who has a crime against nature that's putting them on the registry.
And then people in the other 11 districts, they could then use this as supporting information?
Well, anybody of the whole country can move to Montana, you know, if the Ninth affirms them. But I'm saying if I'm living in Idaho, I'm certainly going to get out of Idaho. I don't know what other states require you to register for a crime against nature, but I certainly wouldn't stay in Idaho if I had to register for that crime.
There's a lot of potatoes there, aren't there?
Absolutely.
Is there anything else on this before we duck out of here?
Let's get out of here.
Excellent. I guess we let's jump over. You wanted to acknowledge a question submitted by someone. You want to go over that super quick?
Sure. We have a subscriber among our inmates subscriber base, and this person subscribes for a year, and he's at a Wisconsin prison. His name is Sean. He sent an amazing question, and we're teasing it now for the next episode. We're going to talk about, will Wisconsin extradite him from a foreign nation if he leaves Wisconsin before completing his supervision when he gets released from prison? And we're going to try to unpack that on the next episode, 178. So tune in if you're interested in leaving the United States and wondering what they likely will do if you flee.
I'm interested in leaving the United States. Jeez. Okay, and then we can move over to Fred is a good friend of mine, and he asked about a clarification on a ruling that occurred, came out of, he posted a link about criminal legal news. It says, Seventh Circuit, Indiana Sex Offender Registration Act's other jurisdiction requirement, unconstitutional violation of right to travel. And you had some thoughts about that one.
Yes, we took this case up on episode 160. So prison legal news or criminal legal news or whoever it is, they're way behind the Registry Matters podcast and FYP education. But what we talked about was that these people had Indiana convictions and they left Indiana and they never would have had to register. As I stated on RM 160, none of these challengers would have been required to register if they, one, had not moved out of Indiana and returned to Indiana after 2006, or two, had not moved into Indiana after 2006. It was in 2006 that Indiana law was amended to include the requirement that forced a person to register if they had relocated to Indiana and had a registration obligation in that state, regardless of whether it was equivalent to Indiana, which is kind of what we've been talking about in previous episodes. But Indiana got a little bit too cute. And so the challengers won on this. They have the right to travel and leave Indiana and return to Indiana and not be disadvantaged because they, in fact, did travel. And that's what happened to them. The mere fact that they traveled caused them to be disadvantaged, and you can't do that. The Equal Protection Clause protects the people of Indiana. You can leave, and you don't get disadvantaged coming back.
So this is only traveling, going to visit your grandmother, and then you come back a week later. That's all this is referring to? These aren't people that are trying to move to another state and then move back?
No, these are people who had moved out and decided to move back.
So
these are people who had left Indiana by virtue of their departure and return. They were being roped in to Indiana's registration scheme, and the travel is what required them to register.
Okay. All right. Then I think we've done this really rapidly, Larry. We can cover some of these articles if you are
we have
a couple questions. My bad.
Yeah.
Yep. Let's hit question one, and I'm going to kind of skip down a little bit. It says, I have two questions. Can those who register post their own signs in the yard? I'm always hearing about sheriffs putting their signs to alert the public of a PFR that lives there. Well, could you post your own? Here are some examples. When the stigma is removed, people will no longer be afraid to seek help, and lives will be saved and restored. Less than 1% of sex crimes are committed by someone outside of the family. Rape is defined as whoever, sleight of touch in Arkansas, flight. I can't read that word, Larry.
So, however slight of the
touch.
Oh,
however slight. Okay. I gotcha. And then the second question is, why doesn't Arkansas have a halfway home for level 3 or 4 offenders? Cummins Unit 11 filled with guys who have been granted parole, but because of their level have nowhere to go. And men have died here of old age waiting. God, that's just awful. Hey, you've been granted parole, but sorry, there's no place for you to go. So stick around.
I want to take the last question first.
Sure.
About halfway houses. Why doesn't Arkansas have halfway houses? Normally, halfway houses are more often operated by private entities, these nonprofits. Somebody who has a corrections background or some kind of counseling background, they get together and they get a little money together and they form a halfway house. And they call it some type of rehabilitation. And then they go running to the governments, be it state, local, looking for contracts that will take your prisoners. Arkansas is not known for wanting to spend a lot of money on reintegration. In fact, most states are not, but particularly the southern states are not. Halfway houses have a cost associated with them. You're running a program in a halfway house. They cost money. So trying to secure funding for placement of people in halfway houses is very difficult, particularly if you fit in the PFR category. And then there's one other thing that I want to pontificate about, and that's everybody says, wouldn't it be great if we have a risk-based system? Well, Arkansas, in fact, does have a risk-based system. And the level 3s and 4s have been determined to be higher risk to the community. So if you were running a halfway house, hypothetically, pretend you have a halfway house, Andy, and pretend that you want to keep, pretend you want to keep your funds flowing and you want to keep good relations with the community, because being accepted in the community is an integral part of operating a halfway house. Tell me, if the word got out that you were accepting level 3 and level 4s, now remember, they have gone through this lovely process that's individualized. Do you think the community that you operate in would be more accepting of your presence or less accepting? And do you think that the governmental entities that provide funding for reintegration, do you think they would be more or less willing to provide that funding? That's a compound question. But
sure. I mean, and I'm going to then expand. 3s and 4s are people that have been deemed to be more susceptible to reoffending than level 1s and 2s?
Correct.
Then, I mean, doesn't that make logical sense that would pose challenges for the community?
That's my point. So the halfway houses that do operate in Arkansas, when they're trying to remain as an acceptable partner in the community and have city zoning and county zoning and all these people off their behinds, the last thing they're going to do is stick their neck out and be willing to take the highest risk offenders in the state. Now, remember, the lovely risk-based system is what, this is not a categorical approach in Arkansas. There's actual process. You go through Pine Bluff and there's a risk assessment done. So this is one of the downsides when people think it's a panacea. When I tell them, no, it really actually isn't a panacea. This is one of the examples. The people who have had to go through that process now can't be reintegrated because they're deemed high risk. So that, on the second part of the question.
Oh, go.
Second part of that question is, that they have their reasons as business people to not take level 3s and level 4s in the halfway houses that do exist.
Okay. Let me just throw this. So if someone had been convicted of a very, very, very minor crime, but then they end up going through this leveling process and they are deemed these level 3s and 4s, if they had a categorical system, I think that's the word you used. If they had that kind of system, they may have just been, based on the crime, been leveled very low, but because of the risk-based system, then they got leveled very high. It's a double-edged sword. It could go either way.
Absolutely. And in fact, the people who think that they would be leveled low in the risk-based systems are typically leveled higher. People automatically assume with a non-contact offense that those people get candy, easy, kid-glove treatment, that you don't get that. In fact, those tend to be the most repeated offenses, and they tend to be rated very high. So oftentimes people who think they would be just in the fantasy world of being low level because they have a non-contact, they would not. If you repeat something enough times, like streaking, indecent exposure, they don't refer to it as streaking anymore. But you could be rated very high in Arkansas's system because you've done it more than once. But yet, the mere act of streaking does not put anybody in physical danger. Well, I guess you could possibly have a heart attack if you saw something you hadn't seen before. but there's no real danger to the community of a person engaging in that. But you could end up in a high risk. Yes. So that's a good analogy.
There was a very famous song about that song. Are you familiar with that song?
Yes. So the first part of the question about the signs, that's a great question. Because in our case in Georgia, that is one of the defenses that the sheriff of Butts County has said. He said, well, nothing precluded them from putting up their own signs to counter our signs. Now, of course, they didn't tell the people that at the time. You know, we assume that you don't care much for our signs, and you can certainly put a counter message. But they're arguing that in court right now in the 11th Circuit. Here's what I'd say to you. If you put that sign up while you're under supervision, I can just about guarantee you that you will have a horrendous amount of adverse consequences. Now, Arkansas, he's more than likely going to have a huge amount of supervision because they are fond of imposing very long sentences in Arkansas. And then after a period of time, they're eligible for parole, and they serve the balance of that in the community. Very similar to what Georgia does. If you put a sign up like that, your PO is not going to be happy with you, and they won't violate you for that. They won't say because you put a sign up. Here's what they will say, though. They will say that you are showing behavior characteristics that are not conducive to accepting responsibility, and that you're not responding well to this officer's motivation to turn your life around, and that you are a risk to the community by the fact that you're still in denial. That's what they will say. So go ahead and put the sign up, find out what happens.
I can't imagine why somebody would want to. I mean, we're arguing in court over having the signs placed that draw attention. Why would you then put a counter message up, like in advance of almost, and draw that attention to yourself? Like, God, like I would just want it to go away, and hopefully nobody noticed it while I was there.
So, well, make sure I clarify. When I say go ahead and put the sign up, see what happens, that is code speak for do not put the sign up because bad things.
Yes,
bad things will happen if you do that.
Obviously, that's not what you would want to do. Yeah, I agree that this would be you being facetious and sarcastic, going, "Don't do that." Very interesting. Yeah, and like that last one, like that sounds like a bad idea. Anywho, but it's a neat question nonetheless.
It is. That's why I put it in here. I just got that today, and I loved it so much. I said I've got to answer this guy's question.
Okie dokie, and then here is another letter that came in. It says, "Dear FYP," I really like how that sounds, Larry. Andy and Larry, I'm an inmate at Washington State doing time for a PFR kind of crime, and I saw the ad for Narsol in Prison Legal News and decided to get a subscription. Wow, I was shocked to find a group that actually advocates for PFRs instead of against us. I think I share the same sentiment as many other PFRs in that I'd like to do more, but I understand I am hindered by my situation. As the old adage goes, it's a thought that counts. I also recently bought a 1-year subscription to your podcast. Sweet. Thank you so very much. Anyway, I know you guys get hundreds of letters and questions, so I'll try to keep this short. In the January and April issues of the Narsol newsletter, there was a 2-part article about the pseudoscience of the polygraph and speculation loophole. That completely sucked, by the way, and I had to wait 2 months to get the second half of the article that I really wanted to read. I can tell you firsthand that the speculation loophole definitely exists here in Washington. Most PFRs in Washington State have the polygraph stipulation in their judgment and sentence, and it causes a lot of angst amongst our demographic. The article states the best advice is to seek the protection of legal counsel by having your attorney accompany you as a witness and advisor during the polygraph interrogation process. That's a really neat idea, Larry. It is advised that you answer controversial or incriminating questions with the response, "I request my attorney to respond to that particular question." I was unaware that I could even have legal representation during a polygraph, and so was everyone else that I shared the article to. So I've got some questions, and I'm really hoping that you can address these in your podcast so I can read about it. First, I know that many of the cases that are talked about in Narsol are federal, so I'm wondering, I don't think that's true, Larry, that they're talked about in NARSAL are federal, so I'm wondering if the advice given is directed at federal PFRs, or does the advice work at the state level too? Second, if I defer my questions to my attorney, does that not still subject me to speculation loophole as being deflection or avoidance? Third, going along with the second, can I be jailed or violated for requesting an attorney answer my question on my behalf? FYP, thank you for all you do, and NARSAL do for us. And sincerely, there's a PS. In case you wanted to... Oh, okay. Then run. Very good. Oh, that's kind of neat, Larry. Can you bring your attorney to your polygraph?
I can tell you that I did not write that article. Now, I am the publisher of the newsletter, but I have to confess I didn't read it. But I can tell you this. I would not have given that advice. I would never tell anyone to try to take your attorney to a polygraph examination. That will not go well for you. That would be just like the advice we gave to the previous person about put the signs up and find out what's happened. Yeah. If you show up for a polygraph examination with an attorney, it is not going to go well for you. And in theory, it sounds good because you have the right to an attorney and you have the right to have that attorney present before any questioning will ensue. The problem is this is not a criminal investigation. This is a tool that's being used to determine if you're complying with treatment and the terms of your supervision. And showing up with an attorney would set off all sorts of machinery that you would not want. Because first of all, you don't know what the questions are. The questions are composed when you get there, and they're reviewed with you in the pretest interview. So therefore, you have the opportunity in the pretest interview to object to the questions or to narrow the questions or to phrase the questions in a way that it will not provoke an adverse response. Like if a person says, have you ever had sex with a person under the age of consent? That's too broad. You'd say, I have no problem with that question, but we need to narrow it. What is the age of consent? And what age are you talking about, have I ever? Because ever means always. So we need to narrow that question down. Have I ever had a sex with a person under the age of 16, if that's age of consent in your state, since I was over the age of 18? Then you've got a narrower question. But if you just say, I'm not answering that question because it incriminates me, that is not going to go well for you. If you have an attorney say, my client's not going to answer any questions because it could be incriminating, that is not going to go well for you. I would not advise that course of action.
Let me also, if you were also under the age of consent doing this, then it may not be a crime where you were. So answering the question in the affirmative could give you a lot of problems when you didn't actually like break any laws.
It indeed could. But his question is about asserting his right to an attorney to accompany him to a polygraph. And if you do that, I'm not aware of it having been done. But if you do that, the polygrapher is going to go bonkers. I doubt that the test will be administered. They're going to notify the PO that you didn't comply with the test. The PO is either going to, depending if they have arrest powers or not, they're going to come out and take you into custody if they have arrest powers. If they don't have arrest powers in your state, they're going to notify the court that you refuse to cooperate with a polygraph exam and ask for a summons or a warrant, one or the other, and it's not going to go well for you. I cannot advise this course of action. I know I'm being conservative. You can be jailed for not cooperating with this because it's in the statute of our state. And I can't speak for the state that he's writing about, but I can speak to our state. It's in the statute that polygraphs can be used to monitor compliance and treatment. If you refuse to cooperate with those, that is a violation of your supervision that could and likely would result in you being jailed. I don't like to see people go to jail, so I cannot advise that course of action. And does it apply to federal, those decisions? No. They happen to be in federal court because that's the choice that courts, if you're going to bring a cause of action, you have a better chance of A, not having a politicized outcome because the judges are there for life, and B, the attorneys bringing the cause of action, if they prevail, are going to be able to be paid. And most PFRs don't have the financial resources. So although they were in federal court, that doesn't narrow that in any way. In fact, I think the Utah Supreme Court, after the Von Behring case in the 10th Circuit, I think the Utah Supreme Court handed down a similar decision based on Von Behring. So it's the Constitution. The question is about incrimination. And is the threat of incrimination real are speculative. The Von Behring case in the Tenth Circuit was a little bit murky in terms of where you can draw the line and refuse to answer the question. You can't just refuse to be polygraphed. I think you have a story to tell about a guy in Georgia who, after Von Behring was decided, he gave an ultimatum about polygraph. Tell the audience what happened to him.
Well, he tried to do that, and they locked him up anyway. Yeah, but he tried to refuse the entire thing. Von Behring just tried to refuse a single question, or maybe just a couple questions. This dude was like, I'm not taking that because of this Colorado decision. He refused the whole thing.
Well, showing up with an attorney will be viewed. Attorneys are viewed as adversary. And that in our adversarial system, that's not an unreasonable position. And you show up for treatment or for a polygraph with an attorney, that is going to be viewed as an adversarial stance, and it's not going to go well.
Let's go up to that first question, talking about, is NARSAL more of like talking about federal things, or is it working at the state level? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. That was the first question that you just covered.
Yeah, I was saying that in federal court, that's where the more of the decisions are, but it's not entirely limited because the Constitution about self-incrimination, that's a federal constitution that applies in all the states. Your state constitution has to give at least the same level of protection as the federal constitution. Now, you can go above, but you can't go below. So you cannot force a person to incriminate themselves. The question is really murky here about where does a polygraph become incriminating, and that's what the pretest interview helps you figure out.
A person in chat is asking this, so you would get punished for using your legal right, and that's what you're just describing right there. Is like you're not really sure. Is this is just almost like your PO is asking you a question, kind of off the cuff almost. I realize it's an interrogation thing. I realize all that, but you're not in a legal proceeding. And as you've described, if you stick to your guns and don't lie, and tell an answer and then stick to it and say I did not do the violation, you stand by that you've never seen anybody violated for this.
Well, what I've said is I've never seen the petition for revocation say only in the petition that the person showed deception on a polygraph. I have seen quite a few petitions say that the person showed deception on a polygraph, and subsequent to the post-test interview, they made the following confessions to this PO. I've seen that. But I don't advise anyone to lie. FYP is not in the business of advising people to misrepresent. I'm telling you this: if you've taken the polygraph and if you've spoken truthfully, you should not change your position because they say you're showing deception. My answer would be, I told you the truth. And then when they say, well, why are you showing deception? Say, if I could explain your machine, I would have so much wealth. I don't know what I'd do with it all. But I can't explain why your machine is showing that. All I can do is tell you the truth, and that's what I've done.
I can't tell you how the Kabuki machine told you that I was deceiving you. And then I guess
and they're going to keep pushing you. They're going to say, "Do you have anything you want us to tell us?" And you know, we're grown up here, and we're adults, and we're here to help. Trust me, they're not there to help. That I can guarantee you.
Let's just make the assumption for the second question that we did bring the attorney into the office for the polygraph, for the Kabuki machine. It says, if I defer my question to an attorney, does that not still subject me to the speculation loophole as being deflection and avoidance?
That's exactly what it's going to do. They're going to see that as all sorts of obstruction. And it, believe me, it's not going to go well. If someone has a contrary experience that they've brought an attorney in and it's gone well, please share it with FYP.
And then going along with that, do you think then if we did have the attorney there and we did deflect a question, defer one to the attorney, do you think that we're going to get arrested for that one?
I don't think you're going to ever get to that point. Honestly, I think if the attorney's there, the test is not going to go down. Okay. I really don't. I don't think they're going to test somebody with an attorney sitting there.
Back up at the top of this, he talked about, is NARSAL like focused more on the federal side of things? I'm trying to see where that was. I remember going by it. I don't consider NARSAL to be that at all.
Well, the way I interpret that, he was asking if this is the case law is only pertaining to federal. Did he say, does NARSAL only focus on federal? Because that's not true.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm going after. And maybe while I was reading it, I wasn't quite analyzing that the right way. That's what the way that I thought that he was asking that. Can you just clarify that then? Is NARSL just focused on national kind of legislation, or are they advocates at the state levels too?
Absolutely. In fact, the opposite. We focus more on state stuff. We don't have any advocacy to speak of at the national level.
Right. Because there's not a lot of, it happens to be like porn kind of related things. That's probably the biggie that's a federal, because that happens to cross state lines.
Right. And plus there's no federal registry. So we can't fight a non-existent entity.
Larry, you know there's a federal registry and you just won't admit it.
Oh, sure I do.
I'm being very facetious. Very, very, very. I don't want anyone to come back and say, oh, you said on 177 that there's a federal registry. No. Show me where it is.
It looks like we've run out of time without getting to any articles.
We did. Is there anything that you want to cover super quickly before we move out of here?
I think we can carry some over to next episode.
Outstanding. So we got to cover, we got a new patron. This is the second person to then do the annual subscription, which I'm super thankful for. And this is Brent. And I'm going to let you announce the new, this is like the Larry Snail Mail subscriber list. Who are the new folks there?
Oh, I've already forgotten.
All right. Well, it's Sean and Eddie. There are the two folks there.
And we just did Eddie's question.
Outstanding. And so thank you very much, guys. If you happen to pick up one of these in prison, there should be a subscribe form at the bottom of it to make life easy. But otherwise, as maybe you know folks in prison, and then we could get them subscribed and push this in. God, this would be great if we could get this into more prison and provide this information, because these are like the seedlings. If we want to indoctrinate people, we can indoctrinate them while they're still in prison. When they get out, they can become lifelong subscribers to the FYP network and gain information and start their advocacy work while they're still in.
Absolutely. And I hope Eddie doesn't cancel his subscription now that I've answered the question.
Right. You should sugarcoat these. When people pay, Larry, you should make that sure that the answer is what they want to hear, not something that's true.
Absolutely. Right? I'll remember that.
Larry, as always, you do amazing legal analysis, and I can't thank you enough. And I hope you have a fantastic rest of your weekend. And sorry, I need to say these things. Registrymatters.co is the website. And you can find all the show notes and other things there. But registrymatters.co is where you need to go. And patreon.com/registrymatters to support the show. And with that, Larry, I bid you adieu, and I hope you have a wonderful weekend. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to FYP.